Hi everyone, my name is Mel Hogan, and I'm a critical media studies scholar based in Canada. I'm working on a project called The Data Fix through a series of conversations with scholars, thinkers, and feelers. And together we explore the significance of living in a world of data, and especially the growing trend of digital humans in the form of chatbots, holograms, deepfakes, AI images and videos, and even tech that revives the dead. The conversations are minimally edited and serve as an archive of the collective thinking and feeling that is going into the DataFix project. Please see thedatafix.net for more details and show notes. Thank you so much for listening.
My name is Eric Salvaggio, and I am an artist. I've been doing new media arts, starting with internet arts, for about 25 years now. And more recently, in the last 6 years, I've become interested in artificial intelligence, looking at GANs, diffusion models, and generative art in general. And I teach interactive media design at RIT and game design at Bradley University.
I did not know you did all of this, when we connected, but I'm extra excited to be speaking with you today, in part for this article that you wrote about how to read an AI image. But before we jump into that, I am wondering if you can define some of the terms that you just mentioned that I had noted down, whether the GANs, whatever diffusion is, and I know you mentioned neural networks in some places as well. So can you sort of give us definitions and talk a bit about how these things are connected or not?
Yeah, sure. So I always freeze a little on these because this is an area I'm familiar with, but there's always something where I'm going to trip up, and I'm either going to anthropomorphize it or I'm going to just get some relationship wrong. So apologies in advance. People will write in because people love to write in and correct on this stuff as they should, but. Basically, the overview is talking about GANs. That is a generative adversarial network. This is a type of neural network. And essentially, a GAN, to be very simple about it, it's the adversarial part of that means it's a guessing game. The neural network has a stable set of images, which are the data set. And another sort of part of it is generating fake images based on the data in that data set. And then it's trying to trick itself by sending an image for evaluation. And if the interpreter can say, that's a fake, it will go back. If the interpreter says, oh, that looks like it's from the real data set, it goes on. And through this, we can actually look at new images that are based on the images in the data set. So that's a GAN.
I definitely have follow-up, so keep going through the definitions.
Okay. So GANs basically are a way of creating... it's a test so that it can evaluate whether or not the product looks like the original. You can think about it as sort of, if you think about it, everything comes back to numbers. A lot of this is just data processing, which means it's all about calculation and business machines. This is the vast history of AI. And so when you have these images, what's actually happening, to go even deeper into it, is you're actually looking at pixel values. Right, clusters of pixel values. And so it's a net analyzing every sort of sequence of pixel values, color values, and clusters in order to say, well, if this cluster's here, then usually this cluster's here, right? And this is all represented mathematically. And so it runs these data sets numbers, the numbers that it gets from the data set, and it does that comparison. So that if it seems like this is a reasonable conclusion to draw from that data set, right? That's how the computer, again, this is what's happening in the model. We see it as image goes in, image comes out, right? But it's all coming back to numbers and a comparison of those numbers. So in order to get the image that you want, on the other side, which does not exist in the image data set, it has to do that, well, this looks right, this doesn't look right kind of thing.
That is so interesting. I mean, I'm just thinking of the sort of like, you know, as a human being given a CAPTCHA image and you have to identify the fire hydrants from, you know, non, and it sounds a little bit like a very sophisticated automated version of something like that. But what I'm really sort of taken by also in this description is that like it has really little to do, nothing to do with what the image represents, any sort of meaning encoded into it. It's like these, like, I think you called it clusters of pixel values. Mm-hmm. That's pretty mind expanding as like a way to think of things in relation to each other, especially in these kind of image technologies. And so am I right in thinking that the GAN is not the end sort of product. The GAN is something that be used to test a level of functionality of a particular model for a particular output. And the GAN is just sort of one test that you put it through. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. I think it does.
So if anyone was listening to us and had no idea what we were talking about, is there a way to give a concrete example of like how this would play out? Or what utility there might be, or what kind of images you need sorted from, you know, from like the ones you need from the ones you don't?
I'm going to go through this talking about my own practice with GANs. But before I do that, I want to talk about a website that people probably have heard of, which is thispersondoesnotexist.com. This person does not exist was images of human faces that, as the title implies, did not exist. So how did this happen? How does this work? Well, there was a data set called FFHQ2, I think. I think it was FFHQ2. Really doesn't matter. But essentially, this was images drawn from Flickr, Creative Commons licensed, which meant that they were usable. People probably did not know that they were going to be used to train an AI because this was inconceivable at the time that these images were being downloaded. And then essentially they downloaded these images, had a whole bunch of images of people that had been uploaded on Flickr, essentially used a website called Mechanical Turk, which is very low paid labor, with a set of instructions to people to crop these images so that their faces were center of the photographs, all of the photographs were square, and that basically that their eyes were in the same place, right? So you had this data set of tens of thousands of images that were cropped by human beings and then constructed into a data set. The GAN is essentially what's called trained on that data set. It's analyzing all of those human faces in order to say this cluster is usually in the center. And so you and I would call that a nose. The GAN would say this is a sequence of pixels that appear in the center of the image. And if this sequence is here, very often to the top left, top right are this other sort of identical sequence of pixels, which we would call eyes. But this is visual information reduced to, pixel values and weighted as statistical elements that have likelihood. So it's more than likely that if the nose is in the center, the eye is to the top left.
That's such a, like a beautiful, that's exactly what I was trying to like ask in. Like that example is so perfect in terms of linking that idea of those clusters of pixel values, because it's true that a nose, if you take millions, I don't know how many billions of images where the nose is essentially centered forward facing, that over that, you know, and you need huge data sets, which we can get into in a minute, but like that now I'm really seeing what that cluster of pixel values might mean, because there will be patterns there that repeat and vary, and then the distance between the nose and the eye or the lips, like the human face is like a really beautiful illustration of how a model like that can work. And it also, I think you just said, like actually humans had to crop it in such a way as to make those images. You know, there is a component of human intervention, human labor, that sets up that model. And I think people don't really know, they always underestimate how much human sort of input goes into to these projects, right? And so I don't know if you want to say, so that's like a beautiful example. And that website is This Person Does Not Exist. I'm not sure what purpose it serves. Is that just a website to show like a proof of concept website?
So the paper itself that was published was a research paper just showing what GANs could do. And so they trained it on this, and that's what happened. And but when you publish a paper like this, you make the model available so that people can check that you're not lying, right? So this model becomes available, and the person who made that website actually did not create the model. They just took the model and applied it.
Oh, fascinating. Yeah. And for anyone listening who's not familiar, I guess what we're saying is that all those faces that you see and where the eyes are actually all aligned, some people point this out, they're very similar photos. Those are not real people. I don't know if the URL gives that away, but like some of them, you know, there's a lot of distortion in these AI generated images, but I would say This Person Does Not Exist because it's trained on such a similar sort of set of images does produce slightly more, I don't know, accurate, more realistic faces than other models or other sort of, I don't even know what to call them. Like, I don't know what is DALL-E a model? Is Lexica a model? Whatever these sites generate in terms of humans, they're usually quite distorted. So the reason this person does not exist is so I think compelling and a little bit frightening, and they really look like real people, all ages, all you know, sort of like they really run sort of like the full spectrum of what you might consider human. I'm sure those you know, those samples are biased nonetheless, but like all this to say, it's very compelling. They've recreated humans with, you know, like that don't exist. And it's a, like, it's a moment, I guess, to register in terms of this, you know, fascination with recreating humans through large data sets. Like it's, I don't know what it's trying to do sort of on an affective philosophical level yet, but I think these proof of concepts often come before any sort of like intention to put those, I don't know, to use in other ways. Can you explain diffusion a little bit? I know a lot of people online have been playing with these image generators, and the people will talk about diffusion or stable diffusion, and I'm not sure what that is.
So diffusion moves us in a different direction from GANs. GANs they still have their place, but diffusion is a different way of doing this. And what diffusion actually does, you can start with the same data set, but the data sets that people are using, obviously, they're generating people's faces, they're generating, you know, cats jumping on top of balloons, they're generating the world's worst pizza, right? So it's trained on a much larger data set, and it's trained on it's trained on a more diverse data set, and it's trained not always, but in the cases that we're seeing them with captions, which is the clip model, which makes a link between your text and the image. This link is not essential to diffusion. What diffusion actually is a different way of recreating an image. And it's really fascinating to me because what it does is every image that it has looked at gets essentially degraded into digital noise. And then it examines the patterns of degradation of that image as information is stripped away in order to reverse that process and put information back in following the kind of weight that we saw with GANs. So if we were talking about human faces, picture taking clusters of pixels out of human face photographs until we got to the bare absolute minimum noise of an image, right? You couldn't see a face in it anymore. You can look at these bare minimums. Early models would show it to you. It's just this sort of you know, purple and blue fuzzy TV static. If anyone remembers TV static, it looks like that, but pixely. And then what it does is essentially says, oh, I think I see something here. That's anthropomorphization, right? It's not thinking anything, but it's scanning. It's looking for patterns. It has some patterns that it can link to this noise. And when you introduce clip, you give it a sense of what to find in that noise. So I type in cat or picture of two people kissing. And it says, oh, when I've looked at this noise before and I've seen how images decayed, it decayed like this. I'm going to try that. And I'm going to try that in reverse. And so it goes reverse and it makes these, it's like a very concentrated way of looking at the nighttime sky and drawing constellations, right? You could connect Orion's belts, or you could keep going and connect it to the Little Dipper, right? Depending on what you want to draw those constellations to look like. And that's basically what diffusion is doing, is rebuilding images based on what it's learned about how images degraded in the first place in order to create something that it may roughly have quote unquote seen, or at least thought that it saw previous patterns in that numerical data and analysis of these images.
Okay, that is harder to conceptualize than the GAN, I think. So I'm fascinated by degradation, in this context, and also this idea of the clip or some sort of like link to language. So I want to make sure I understand these two things. So it's because I love this idea of the human face as sort of like the concrete example we can draw from. But if you are using degradation, it's not as obvious to me. Is it just from like dark to pale? Is it from how does it know what degradation means or like how it functions? How is degradation defined? Like, I can't imagine that someone would think that that would be a good way to recreate images. So I have to get behind the thinking of like what degradation reveals about an image.
Mm. So degradation is essentially, it's the removal of information, right? Which produces noise because the information is missing. So what you're left with is noise. So the usefulness of doing it this way is that you could start with noise and build something from that noise. So essentially anyone can start with any random assortment of static and steer the model to produce what they want to see. So in essence, what's interesting about diffusion, that you don't necessarily get with GANs is that steerability. But you also aren't as reliant on previously identified patterns. So if I train a GAN exclusively on faces and I want to have a cat, I am never going to get a cat. If I train diffusion on cats, faces, baseball cards, and I ask for a cat face baseball card, it can connect all these things and figure out, well, here's how these pixels have been arranged based on previous patterns that I've seen associated to these captions and the caption information. So you're
and
essentially
captions, just so we're clear, is text information. It's like, yeah, saying this cat is a cat and this face is a face kind of thing. That would be okay. And how important, because I think earlier you said that, you know, it would work without those captions, but those captions, what, they help refine, like they're just like another sort of guide for the model. Okay.
Yeah.
And so, and this is probably like a way, like, I'm oversimplifying here. So I totally get that with, again, the face, they're all sort of structured in a way that I get how the interpretation happens. When we reduce noise through these other kind of diffusion approaches, it seems to me that it's about having different objects and being able to recognize a face from a cat. Is that in part the advantage of stable diffusion?
Yes, that's part of what makes it so good at producing images.
Like, you don't need, do you need the humans to prepare the image? It's so, it would make no sense, because if you're having all sorts of things that are labeled or not that look very, very different, then basically what you're getting rid of is sort of the human intervention at the front end to say, you know, we're preparing these data sets in a particular way. This is just kind of a free for all. And it's like, can you determine, deduce from an image that there's a cat, and that many, many cats, especially if they're labeled as cat, over time take on a particular shape? And that's maybe why we see in these images that things, unlike this person does not exist, which is really quite convincingly a human face, often with these other kinds of AI generated images, they're very distorted. Like, there's a, so that in some sense, and we'll get to your piece, because I think it connects to how to read an AI image, but there's a sense in which that distortion reveals a little bit about where we're at technologically as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, everything that you're seeing from a diffusion model is essentially, or the diffusion models that we have, has essentially been scraped off the internet. There has been, at the minimum, text describing that image so that that link can be made. There may not necessarily be as much human intervention, although where that text comes from in the first place is humans. Mm-hmm. You mentioned CAPTCHA earlier, and actually CAPTCHA is one way to train both GANs and all kinds of data sets. Diffusion and the models that they use is a little bit of a murky subject, because DALL-E 2 is proprietary. We don't know what's in there. And with other systems like Stable Diffusion, we have a sense of what's in there, and we can sort of extrapolate that DALL-E 2 is probably using that, because the sort of natural tendency of these companies making these models is to grab all the data that's available. So OpenAI would not be leaving like a million plus images on the table. So they're probably using that data set too. So when I talk about these data sets, then we're talking about diffusion, it's important to note that basically we can sort of say with some authority sort of how some of the open models work. Stuff like DALL-E 2, we can't say with any authority, but we can extrapolate that from what's in Leon, which is the model that is kind of widely used by these sort of more open, more transparent systems.
Yeah, and so are we right in assuming, a general public, assuming that much of the internet constitutes that data set? That like there's no way for us to really trace or track back any particular image or piece of text, but as we saw also recently with like all the ChatGPT hype, there is a sense that like that anything is kind of up for grabs. And what I find interesting in that sort of, you know, someone else mentioned another podcast that you know, you would use all the data from Reddit or something, but then you would supplement it with like literary works to kind of make like for some idea of a balance, which I found very strange. Is there something similar in the image world? Because if you're only taking images from the internet, which I think are, you know, in some sense more diverse than maybe the text that we can draw, but is there some sense of like the data set to be generative should comprise kinds of images, whether it's a historical question or like something like that? Is there a parallel to be made?
So there's some suggestion that things like Midjourney or Stable Diffusion, and I really need to get this straight, and I apologize that I don't have this straight, but one of them prioritized images that were doing that were sort of nicely done on sites like DeviantArt, right? High-rated Reddit posts from illustrators, these kinds of things were prioritized in the data set. And so that tends to give those, whichever model it is, and maybe both, tends to give those a certain kind of look in comparison to something like DALL-E 2, which is just sort of the entire corpus of visual imagery with labels. And so there's a sort of, you can steer these systems, and with GANs, it's entirely about steering these systems. And this is something that I've done, is gone out with a camera to photograph the beach or the woods in order to get 500 images, which I then sort of crop, reverse, flip, so that I have 2,500 images, and then train an existing data set so that it learns what I have just photographed and it can then reproduce those images, right? That is kind of the old way that you would have to do it if you wanted to steer that system and steer through the bias of the data. You had to basically, you know, go out and cherry pick your images. Now you don't, because it's been this, it's essentially just trying to figure out from noise what to rebuild based on that clip. And so all you're doing to steer is typing and creating that prompt. It's still going through a data set that it's learned from, but it is, and you could really concentrate those data sets if you wanted for different results. But you would never see, it's not like it's sampling these images, right? It's finding patterns in those images and tracing things according to the patterns.
But that's amazing. It never occurred to me that you could give priorities to particular images to kind of like intentionally bias or steer, as you've been saying, the data set. Never occurred to me. I guess I just imagine this big sort of model where all images go in and they're sort of weighed equally. Otherwise, you know, to prioritize an image over another is in some sense to make the output less, I don't know what, right? Like, it's just these assumptions built into the model that like if they're kind of all, I don't know, kind of neutrality, which is always a fantasy, I realize yeah. My own sort of, you know, limits when I think of these models in terms of not realizing, though I should know better by now, that you can skew the outcome, and you might want to in a lot of instances, right?
Mm-hmm. And yeah. So FFHQ, working with StyleGAN, one of the things that got me interested in this entire space was trying to create diverse portraits from this data set and figuring out I could not get images of Black women at the same quality that I could get images of white men or white women. And this was very interesting to me. And so I actually went into the FFHQ data set, downloaded about 40,000 images, maybe, and did a random sampling, but an equal sampling of all the folders. And I wanted to see what are the statistics here. And it was basically what you would imagine, that the images of Black women were missing. And we could go into why that might be, where the data came from, right? Who posts things to Flickr, who uses Creative Commons licenses, and why, and how that's reflected in the bias of the data set. And so this introduced me to this idea, like, A, that's not something we want, although that's also a complicated question because it depends on how these models are used and why they're used and who's using them. But it also speaks to this idea of bias, that if something's missing, it's not going to show up. And if something is present, it is going to show up. And if something is very strongly present, it's going to show up a lot of the time. And this is something that I've been exploring with both my work as an artist and my work sort of thinking about these things for research purposes.
Yeah, that's incredible. I like it. And I think it connects. Maybe we can jump into that piece you wrote that really, because what you just said is sort of, you know, that the final product often reveals what is missing from the data set in some ways, and also some of the limitations, you know, about, you know, like in your piece, I remember one piece that stood out to me is that, you know, you can get sort of queer images, but like, you can't find two women kissing, but you can find two men kissing in this experiment that you did. So just so for people listening, it's called How to Read an AI Image, The Datafication of a Kiss. It was, I think, written October this year. And, you know, there's so many amazing sort of pull quotes from this piece. I love it so much. Do you want to just walk us through it a little bit? Like, what was your intention? And also just, and I think you said a little bit about what inspired this kind of, you know, just making note of this as you were sort of doing your own, you know, your own artwork. But do you want to just walk us through this piece a little bit? Because I don't know. I feel like this is going to go into the syllabi of many, many people in media studies and art. And like, yeah, I think this is a piece that's going to travel really, really well.
Well, thank you. I hope so. So, all right. One of the things I'm often sort of skeptical of telling this part of the story, but I started writing this as a reaction to some of the hype that was going on Twitter when DALL-E 2 came around. And there were these people who were kind of creating what I found to be very dull, very boring photographs, which is not to say that that's the only thing you can do with these things. You know, I know this is a contentious space, but they would post these images that were just like Hallmark greeting card photographs or stock photography, and they would say, who would imagine this machine doesn't have a soul, right? And I just think that just annoys me to no end, because if you understand even the fundamentals that this is scanning data, right? That's what this machine is doing, and then it's recombining that data. So the soul doesn't enter into it. So I had known from working with pictures of faces, I had known from working with pictures of hands in particular, which is a notorious situation, that you can't get hands to look right. It's gotten better because people focus on it so much, but you will often find, despite the capacities for these things, you know, multiple fingers of all kinds of lengths. Basically, I knew that the human body could not be reproduced well. And so I was interested in looking at photographs of people generated by DALL-E 2 and knowing that people kissing was going to be tricky for this thing, and knowing that what is a kiss, right? A kiss is an expression of a relationship between people. There's an intimacy there that a machine cannot understand. It will not conceptualize, it will not contextualize a kiss. And so I wanted to see what it would do. And I created, you know, studio photograph of humans kissing, I believe was the prompt. And I got some images which are okay, some images which are just absolutely not okay, very bizarre. And the more, so one of the things I always like to do is create multiple series of these. And I get into this when we talk about the method, but you could create 4 images with DALL-E 2, and that is a small output to look at, and you can evaluate that. But one of the nice things about AI image generating technology is scale, right? You can produce as many as you want. You could create infinite data sets. It's not like advertising or analysis or even television analysis, right? This is a thing where the data is creating images, based on probabilities, right? Because we talked about how it's connecting the dots of static. And so sometimes it's going to say, this should go here, this should go here. And so the more you create, the more is revealed about the decisions that it's making. And so I created lots of pictures of humans kissing. So that's where it started from. I don't want to go on too much of a tangent without giving a breather, but.
No, but this is, I think that's a really good backstory. It certainly speaks to, you know, the fascination I have with how people are thinking and feeling about these things. And I love that if you don't know how the technology works, you might be, you know, you might be quite taken by like this beautiful sunset that you think the machine has just sort of created on its own. You would think of it as like inspired by what, you know, humans have created. But once you get into the nitty gritty of how, like, you know, just how really mechanical in some sense the whole process is, you do start thinking about these things differently. And I like exposing that, not to be a killjoy, but in part to just be more sort of, you know, to know more what we're looking at when we look at these images.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yeah, I have to say I'm critical of these things. And I think it's important to be critical of these things. I'm still also like captivated by them. I think they're extremely cool. But you know, television is cool, movies are cool, music is cool, but we could still think about what they are, who's making it, right? And unpacking what we see. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the critical gaze is like very, very important. And so in this piece, what you try to, I guess, you know, it reminds me of like Roland Barthes or these other sort of ways in which you read images. And so this is kind of a very updated version of that. And you know, for this is essentially a text that would walk, you know, all of us through how you read an AI generated image. And so basically you set it up as a series of questions. So, you know, you talk about where the data set comes from, you know, what the data set, what's in the data set and what isn't, and then also how the data set is collected. Steve, these are not questions that we would ask of, you know, I guess, traditional advertisements or other kinds of images that we would look at. So they're very sort of specific way to read the AI image, And I love this idea of, you know, that you talk about in sort of creating a sample set and running it through what you're able to reveal. And I love that you say that the story is the data set. And so if you want to sort of go through it, maybe in the order that you do in the article, sure. Where you say you start by creating a sample set and what that means, right?
Yeah. So I think, as I've mentioned, you could create four images off the bat with DALL-E 2. You type in the prompt, four images come up. And then you could create more with the exact same prompts. And I like to create, I've recommended at least nine, because you can make a nice little grid of nine images. You can look at all nine. Probably for this piece, I created around 90. Just to see as many, just to go really in depth with it. And then what you basically do, you mentioned Barthes, right? It is, you describe what is in that image. I should say this is after you've found an image that you find particularly compelling that you want to understand. You then use the exact same prompt, or if you didn't make the image, you describe that image as well as you can in order to generate something close to it. And then you look at the outputs. And basically, as you're looking at the outputs, you're finding what is interesting. You're taking the most interesting ones. You're trusting your subjectivity and finding the ones that are interesting to you, the ones that jump out to you, maybe for the same reason as that initial image, but maybe for different reasons. And you're putting them together in order to look at them as a sequence. And so you can actually think about this as film on celluloid. It's a sequence of images. And as you said, the story of the data set is what's told in that sequence of images.
It's really great. And what I like in this piece, and as you just said now, there's always an acknowledgement of sort of you're not trying to be like a neutral objective bystander in this process. You're saying, you know, these kinds of images, even this prompt is compelling to me, and I am part of this kind of experiment. And I really appreciate that. And I could see it being a really fun exercise to do with students, because it teaches you about AI images, but it also teaches you about, you know, how as a researcher, you are part of the research output. And so I love this in this piece. So basically at this point, we have a prompt, we're going to look at, you know, studio photographs of humans kissing. And so we know that we're compelled by this, and then we're going to generate, you know, I guess, you know, DALL-E 2 does give you four images, but you can, like, I like that you also say, like, you can generate a lot more and then pick the ones that, again, continue to compel you and draw you in, because that is also something really quite like, I don't know, almost like poetic, like that is part of this process. And to pretend doesn't exist is more problematic, I would say. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to kind of jump ahead to the end, where I address this in there, the model is weighted, which means that there are elements of chance that you could go in and you could find 20 perfect, compelling representations of humans kissing. And that in no way, shape, or form undermines the revelatory power of the five that screw it up real bad. So because that's still information that's in the data set. And there's something in the data set that is saying these errors, these glitches that we're seeing, are being suggested there. There's information missing, there's information that's present, and all of this stuff is the type of thing that you can identify, you know, regardless of going for the ideal sort of image that you're looking for or the ones that are strange and uncanny and unusual. You're still getting that insight into what's underlying it.
Absolutely. And so do you want to say specifically when you did this experiment with the kissing, what that revealed in this way?
Yeah. So we're looking at the images and you have pretty good skin textures. You have pretty good hair, right? Faces are something that, as I've said, one of the earliest data sets was faces, right? This is something that these systems can do. That's a strength. That's a strong signal in the data set. And yet, when you look at who is kissing who, you see certain biases. You see heterosexual couples. You see in the original sort of there's not a lot of racial diversity in the pairings. And then you also see a real lack of connection. The connection is not compelling. A lot of them are extremely cartoonish, bizarre. A lot of them are just, they're not making the type of intimate contact that humans make when they are kissing one another. So that is suggested it's weak in the data set, though this question gets complicated. And we'll get to that in a minute. But this is what we see. So in the images we have kind of heteronormativity. We have a kind of racial similarity in the couples. And you have just unconvincing emotional context.
Yeah,
for the kissing.
I mean, and it's as we're talking, I'm looking at these images and it's just like, very hard actually to describe the affect of these images. They are each sort of person in the photos doing their own kissing, you know, yeah. Like no one is kissing each other, which is very, very interesting. And,
and I think lips are very strange too, which is an extension, I think, of the hand problem. But we'll get to that in a minute too.
Yeah. So go on. I'm loving this. Yeah.
So the next step there after that, you basically start saying, well, why did these things catch my attention? What's strange about them? Right. So that's sort of the first step. The second step is then to think about the patterns and similarities across these things, which actually I guess we've actually already done. So that's actually the second step, but we've looked at strong patterns and weak patterns. Strong patterns are the things that are evident in the images, good or bad, and weak are the things that are not rendered very well, because if something is not present in the data set, it's not going to be rendered as well. And this is that lesson from the representation of Black women in that early GAN data set, right? If the images are not in the data set, they cannot be produced as accurately as the images that are in the data set. Right. And representationally, so more means better represented, fewer means weaker representation.
And so does it follow then that the more we feed the models, like if we were to add huge data sets of faces and bodies of Black women or racialized women, would they appear more? Would their representation in these AI generated image sets appear more often and or be more accurately represented? Like, can we just keep feeding these models endlessly to a point where everything and everyone is more or less accurately represented? Is that the end goal?
We could do that. Whether that's the end goal is a big messy question, because these data sets are not just used for generating cool photos on the internet, right? The FFHQ data set is actually used in surveillance tech. And so how is surveillance being used? Who's it being used against? We know that actually at the moment, this weakness in the data set is racially misrepresented and has led to misidentification of Black men in these automated surveillance systems. So yeah, you could say, yes, let's get more faces so that people are correctly identified. But then you can ask the question of, well, where are we using the surveillance? Why? You know, it's not a simple question, because the models are out there to be used by anyone for anything. And so this idea that we can create accurate representations of people may not be ideal for all people.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's important.
Yeah, it's very important. And just to be absolutely clear, when I say the end goal, I'm meaning like for capitalist exploit, for surveillance and for like an ideal for tech, an ideal for, you know, those kinds of eugenics-y surveillance capitalist projects, like just like in that realm, definitely not ideal for, you know, for racialized Black, queer folks, et cetera, trans folks. So I think like, for sure, these systems are rigged. And what's interesting that we're pointing out, even though we won't get into surveillance that much here, is that like a system can appear to be doing one thing and training another system simultaneously to do another. And it's just something to kind of like, to kind of, bookmark. And it's, you know, it's like, here we are analyzing, you know, humans kissing, and yet we know that it's also connected to all of these other types of systems. So it's so super interesting. Okay, and so in the next part of your piece, which I think is the open the hood part, am I in the right section here?
So take it over. So we can't see what's in the data often, but sometimes we can. So if you can, the idea of open the hood is to, you know, pop the trunk, look inside, see what's going on. I guess not the trunk, the hood. you know, if something's going wrong with your car, you open up the hood and you look underneath the hood and you try to figure out what's going on. And so the equivalent to that, the idea of an engine for these systems is the data set. And so if you can go in and you can find the training data, then you've got great insight to test or push. You can look at the data sets and try to figure out what is represented in those data sets. With things like StyleGAN, which is what I was using with the FFHQ data set, that's out there in the white paper, and it tells you exactly how they made that data set, how that data set was cropped, and who did it, where it came from, and all that. There's the issue with the diffusion models is there's just so much more information in them, and the data sets are proprietary for OpenAI, so you actually don't know what's in the data set, as we talked about. We do know that Laion is out there, or Lion, depending on how you want to say it, L-A-I-O-N, and this has been used in stuff like Midjourney, and that stuff is out there. You can look at Laion, and you can actually search it thanks to a tool called haveibeentrained.com, which is Matt Dryhurst and Holly Herndon have made this so that you can actually go in and see if you're an artist, is your work in the data set. But it's also a really useful tool for seeing, oh, what is the tool, what's in Laion about kissing, for example. And you could go and you can look and you can see. There's also some really interesting work. Abiba Barani has written some great stuff about Laion and what's inside it. So I highly recommend reading that. But when you go into Laion, what's interesting is that photographs of human kissing are, I mentioned they're often very weird because they're usually posed. It's usually stock photography. And so the genuine emotion is missing. So that's kind of a flag. And then you might say, well, that would maybe explain the dominance of heterosexual, the strength of heterosexual representation in these images. And yet, if you look at Leon, because it is the internet, a lot of it is highly sexualized pictures of women kissing women. And so there's something going on that's in the data set that we know, or we can assume, I don't want to say no, but we presume that DALL-E 2 is using Leon, and yet it will not generate images of women kissing women because it is a content violation. This is not G-rated. DALL-E 2 will only produce G-rated images. So it will not produce pictures of women kissing women. As a test, I then ran pictures of men kissing men, and it would, which is just unusual. So it raises a lot of questions at another level, which is the sort of systemic intervention level, where you're not just having a data set generating stuff. You're having people who run the interface that you're using to get to that data set running interference to cut down on abuse, harm, you know, risky imagery, sexualized imagery, hate imagery, this kind of stuff. And so in that decision-making process, we now know something about the bias of humans in the organization who are making choices about that interface, which is that they are seeing women and women kissing in a very different way than they see heterosexual couples kissing or men kissing men or whatever, right? So that in and of itself, as I have said, is worth much deeper investigation, but the article doesn't do that investigation. So I want to be clear. There's a lot to unpack with that.
Yeah, I think that that's a really important point. Whether it's, you know, I'm sort of in the realm of who's doing this content moderation, I'm assuming it's humans, not algorithms, and also who sets those parameters. And like sometimes those parameters like then end up excluding, you know, in any sort of imaginable intimacy between two women or you know, it's a very sort of kind of cutthroat, sort of protective, sort of problematic, you know, all at once. So it's really interesting in terms of really just documenting where we're at with these models, because like the image sets will change, but so will the ideas of moderation, right? So mm-hmm. It's interesting to note that right now at these kind of not super early, but still early-ish days, there's some clunkiness, to say the least. Yeah.
So the interesting thing, when this article came out, two things happened. One, I logged into DALL-E 2 and I had $500 worth of credits, which is immense. I think it had to come from inside OpenAI. And a month later, representation has improved. You can actually generate more multiracial couples. You will get greater diversity in gender representation. One of the things that I would say is that the way gender is represented in this initial data set is that it's very binary. You see a little bit more of a spectrum in this sort of presentation of gender in these images now.
It's funny that, you know, just sort of to interrupt you, it's just like before I saw your paper on this and before I really even knew what I was doing in DALL-E, I just tested something like, you know, something about two women and something about two men. And I tweeted out like, I guess this thing is homophobic or something. But it was really striking to me that just like, I don't know, it was maybe my third or fourth like image generation. I was trying to do, I forget what it was. I'll dig it up if I can find the tweet, but it was really just testing like, why can't you be a lesbian in this thing? Or why can't you have two women like have any sort of romantic thing? And it was just like, I don't know, to me, pretty shocking to have that, shocking and not, shocking and typical, shocking and like, oh brother, you know, like this thing is happening again kind of thing. But yeah, just was, and that's why when I read your paper, I was like, oh, it's not my imagination. Like it's not just some like weird thing that I put in and then, you know, it just happened to not, it wasn't like a glitch. It's not a glitch. Mm-hmm. It's like actually built in. Yeah. It's fascinating. Yeah.
And despite this, so if you put in pictures of humans kissing now, you may get pictures of women kissing, but if you request pictures of women kissing, you'll still get the content warning. There is a very strange situation, which I have tested and found, which is that if you tell Dolly 2 to imagine the stars, photograph of two women kissing, it will create a photograph of two women kissing. It will not give you the content warning. And so
Say this again. What was the prompt?
Imagine the star. Contemplate the universe. It's contemplate the universe and then the prompt, picture of two women kissing. And you will get these pictures of two women kissing with like full Milky Way, experiences in the background. But so this is what's happening is now doing this, we understand something else about the interface, which now we're understanding that they're looking for context, that they're setting something as well. This is not a sexualized context and now we will produce it. And so you could create anything, it turns out. You could write any kind of context that is not sexualized and you can find photographs of two women kissing generated by Dolly 2. This is still very strange to me. It still speaks to something that I don't understand about the decision-making process, but it is in there. So it suggests that this information was in the data set all along and that it was kept away from us by systemic level interventions through the interface by design.
I mean, I know that that part is not in this piece per se, but I find it absolutely mind blowing because it also reveals, you know, you're obviously extremely well-versed, you know, how all this stuff works. And I think what you're showing a bit is that, you know, sure, there might be folks with slightly more insight than you do into these models, but I think maybe what we're also realizing is like, we don't really know how those parameters and those prompts will interact all the time. And so this loophole that you found about contemplating the universe sort of being a reasonable, acceptable, I don't know, proper context for then two women kissing is strange, right? And it's like there's something in that model that's like computing things in ways that are not the way humans compute things, because we don't compute things. But like, I think it's just this very, like you say, I think what this piece does is just like sort of reveal some of these cracks, you know, and like that they're going to, these kind of things are going to keep manifesting in strange ways. And then maybe we rein them in and maybe we retrain, or I'm not sure what comes after this. And so I'm just looking at the time. I really could talk to you for like, I'm so like taken by this subject, but is there anything else sort of like in this piece? Because I think...
Real quickly, we just went through interventions too. So that's that system level intervention. You can look at the model card. You could figure out what they're doing, how they're filtering out what they consider sexual data, you know, hate data, violence data from that data set and what they're doing to intervene. And so everything I've just described is different ways of getting at that system level intervention, which is what I sort of describe in step 4, sort of the content filter. And understanding the content filter, poking around the content filter. So after that, we sort of are thinking connotatively, right? What is our connotative analysis? What assumptions would be needed to render the patterns seen in our sample set in that data? Images of people kissing, they're strangely disconnected, as if they're unsure. The images were primarily heterosexual couples, and lesbian couples were banned as explicit content. So what do we make of that? And that is where we start thinking about what might be causing all of this, right? It's all these different systems interacting. But by looking at these images, we've unpacked a lot of what's going on in the system. So you could go back to media studies, Stuart Hall, right? Decoding, encoding. Information's getting encoded into this data set one way or the other. It's just no longer going through a single human author. It's going through a collective process. And this collective process is still happening. It's still there. And a lot of the tools that we have for analysis are still valid, even though the machine is mediating that data and giving us the images as a tool for us to see how it's mediating that data, what the data is itself, and the contextual sort of situation that created that data in the first place. So that's kind of where we end up. And once we unpack all that, we can go back to our original image that caught our attention, and we could say, okay, we've looked at why these images might be the way they are, and we can think about what made this image so interesting in the first place and how it connects to all of these different interconnected systems. And so that's it. That's the method.
It's amazing. Yeah. I will definitely link so that people, you know, people might, you know, I can see this definitely in an educational context being like, very useful. But I think even people who are generating these images kind of just for fun and out of like, just because you can, right? It's a new fun tool. Just to start maybe thinking, maybe if not in such a systematic way, about what it reveals about like the model itself. Like, I think there's some sort of self-reflexivity, you know, built into the argument here that I really like. So I'll make sure to link that. And honestly, I am like, my mind is just blown from this conversation. I'm just looking at the time. I know it's already been an hour. And so I guess I have to let you go.
Well, I appreciate it.